Chapter 10. "We seem to have been living this life of wandering tinkers forever," said Stephen, "and I must confess it suits me very well. No peevish bells, no responsibilities, no care for the morrow, wholly dependent on the benevolence of others or of Providence. So long that I've almost come to like this Starvacre landscape," said Martin, looking over plain, covered, where it was covered at all, with thin, coarse grass and low bushes, with gum trees of various kinds standing here and there, the whole, in spite of the tracts of bare sandstone rubble, giving a general impression of a dull, silvery, grey-green, hot, dry, and brilliantly lit. It seemed completely empty at first, but far over to the southeast a keen eye, or better, a small spyglass, could make out a group of kangaroos of the largest kind, while troops of white cockatoos moved among the taller, more distant trees. "I sound ungrateful," Martin went on, "for not only has it fed me very well, such quails, such chops, but it's a naturalist's treasure house, and heaven knows how many unknown plants that worthy ass is carrying, to say nothing of bird skins. I only mean that it's wanting in wild, romantic prospects, or indeed anything that makes a countryside worth looking at apart from its flora and fauna. Blaxland assured me that there were wild, romantic prospects farther into the Blue Mountains," said Stephen. And for a while they ate steadily. They were dining on grilled wombat. All their meals were necessarily grilled or roasted. And it ate like tender lamb. "There they go," he cried, "and the dingoes are after them." The kangaroos vanished in a fold of the plain half a mile away, moving at a prodigious speed, and the dingoes, which had presumably relied on surprise, gave up the hopeless chase. "Well, you may say Starvacre," said Stephen, looking east and west. "I remember Banks telling me that when first they saw New Holland and sailed along its shore, the country made him think of a lean cow with bare, scraggy, protruding hip bones. Now, you know very well what affection and esteem I have for Sir Joseph, and I have the utmost respect for Captain Cook, too, that intrepid scientific mariner. But what possessed them to recommend this part of the world to government as a colony, I cannot tell. Cook, who was brought up on a farm. Banks, who was a landowner, both of them able men, and both of them having seen great stretches of its desolation. What infatuation, what wilful—" He broke off. And Martin said, "Perhaps it seemed more promising after so many thousand miles of sea." After a silence, Stephen reverted to their wandering life. "What a time it seems," he said. "Our faces, forgive me, Martin, have already assumed something of that raw brick red so usual in New South Wales. And I think we've seen everything our predecessors have seen. The emu, the echidna," cried Martin, "except the platypus. Blaxland assured me it was not to be found in his neighbourhood, but that it was not uncommon in the streams nearer the coast. He had never seen it, and indeed knew no more than I. It's strange that so remarkable an animal should be so little known in Europe. I've only seen Banks's dried specimen, no dissection possible, and read Hume's superficial paper in the Transactions, together with Shaw's description, neither based on a living animal. Conceivably, our next river, our last, alas, will yield one. How kind Mr. Blaxland was, and what a splendid dinner he gave us," said Martin. "I know I speak like a man whose god is his belly, but this riding and walking and searching for specimens after so many months at sea gives one the appetite of an ogre." "He was indeed," said Stephen, "and where we should have been without him I cannot tell. This is no country to lose one's way in. After one day of wandering in the worst kind of bush, we should have ridden tamely home, if we'd survived at all." Mr. Blaxland, a fellow member of the Royal Society with a large holding inland from Sydney, had made them heartily welcome and had warned them of the danger of getting lost. Just to the south of his land, there were great stretches of a kind of scrub where the leaves joined overhead, where sense of direction was easily lost, and where the parched ground was littered with the bones of absconders. He'd lent them an ass to carry their already overflowing collections, and Ben, a morose, bearded, middle-aged aboriginal, who showed them 100 edible plants, led them within shot of their dinner as though the desolate, featureless plain were marked with signposts, pointed out a whole sparsely inhabited and, to their eyes, almost invisible zoological garden, made fire, and sometimes, when they were to wait for some nocturnal serpent, lizard, opossum, koala, wombat, he built them huts from the great sheets of bark that hung from the gum trees or lay at their feet. For reasons that didn't appear, he was much attached to Mr. Blaxland, but he was not attached to Stephen or Martin, and he was often impatient at their stupidity. He'd picked up some Newgate English from the convicts, and as they stared at what seemed them an undisturbed patch of shale and dead grass, he'd say, "Buggers can't see, fucking track, blind, no see, sods." "And certainly," said Stephen, reverting to Blaxland, "it was a noble dinner. But of all the dinners we've eaten during this journey, the one I enjoyed most took place before ever we set out. For a dinner to be more than usually successful, it seems to me that the host must be more than usually cheerful. And Mr. Poulton was in as fine a flow of spirits as could be imagined, and how well he played! He and Aubrey dashed away as if they were inventing the music by common accord. It was a delight to hear." He smiled at the recollection and then added, "You did have the impression, did you not, that he was happy to know nothing about Padine's evasion?" "More than that. He told me privately that, managed with discretion, it would be thought he'd gone to join his friends in the bush, living with the blacks." "You rejoice my heart," said Stephen. "And speaking of blacks, it occurs to me that some of our difficulty in communicating with this one," nodding towards Ben, who sat at some distance with his back turned, "quite apart from language, is the fact that he and his people have no notion of property. Each tribe has its frontiers, to be sure, but within that territory everything is common. And seeing that they have no herds, no fields, but walk about all the time for their living, any possessions other than their spears and throwing sticks would be a useless burden. To us, property, real or symbolical, is fundamental. Its absence is known to be misery, its presence is thought to be happiness. The language of our minds is wholly different." Ben said, "Shut up, get on horse." They saddled their patient old mares. Ben had nothing to say to straps and buckles. He was a guide and protector of fools for Blaxland's sake. In no way a servant. Indeed, his world didn't include the man and master relation at all. And nothing that they could give him did he want. Mounting, they rode slowly on towards their last river. Their last river offered neither water nor platypus. They walked across, dry-shod. But the monotonous plain had been sloping gently down for some hours, and now there were many more trees, and better grown, so that the landscape could, without very much exaggeration, be said to resemble a park. A dull, ill-tended park. Not altogether without cheer, however, for in one of the taller trees Ben showed them a truly enormous lizard clinging motionless to the trunk, convinced it couldn't be seen. He wouldn't let them shoot it, nor would he use one of the half-dozen spears he carried. He appeared to say that the reptile was his aunt, though this may have been an error of interpretation. In any event, the lizard, having been stared at for 20 minutes, suddenly lost its head, rushed up the tree, fell together with a long strip of loose bark, stood open-mouthed, defying them for a moment, and then raced away over the grass high on its short legs. "He was a pleurodont," said Martin. "So he was, and he had a forked tongue, too. One of the monitory kind, for sure." This kept them cheerful for the rest of the afternoon. And the next day, having looked at Banks's Botany Bay, they rode into Sydney. The horses made straight for their stable, the ass with them. And in the more squalid outskirts, Ben met a group of fellow tribesmen, some wearing clothes. They walked with him to the hotel, talking away at a great rate. And once there, Stephen said, "Mr. Riley, Ben here from Mr. Blaxland's has been with us these 10 days. Pray give him whatever's right." "Rum," said Ben in a loud, harsh voice. "Don't let him do himself too much harm, Mr. Riley," said Stephen. And taking the ass's bridle, he went on, "This is Mr. Blaxland's ass. I shall send him back by a sailor to be collected when one of his wagons comes down." "Good evening, Mr. Davidge," he said, as he stepped aboard and saluted the quarter-deck. "Would you be so good as to have these bundles carried below with the utmost care? Mr. Martin, may I beg you to see that the skins, particularly the emu skins, are laid very gently in the captain's storeroom? The smell will soon go off. Feel not minded. I must go and report our return. And then, Mr. Davidge, may I trouble you for a sober, steady, reliable hand? Place, for example, to lead this ass back to Riley's?" "Well, Doctor, I dare say I can find somebody in his right wits. But Place is lashed into his hammock for the moment, having been pumped over. You can hear him singing Greensleeves if you bend your ear forward." Stephen could also hear the strong, authoritative voice of Captain Aubrey addressing someone in the cabin in formal terms, someone who certainly didn't belong to the ship. At the same time, he also became aware of the nervous tension aboard. Anxious looks, furtive whispering. And the whole ship's company, or very nearly so, gathered at the stations they'd occupy if the frigate were to get under way. "Tell the gentleman who sent you that this note is improperly addressed, improperly phrased, and cannot be received. Good day to you, sir," said Captain Aubrey, clear in the still air. Doors opened and closed. An army officer, his face as red as his coat, came out, made an unsmiling return to Davidge's salute, and crossed the brow. The moment he touched the land, Stephen's ass began a heartbroken, shuddering bray, and all the Shelmerstonians and some of the less respectful man-o'-war's men burst into a rare cackle of laughter, stumping about and clawing one another on the back. Tom Pulling shot up on deck like a jack-in-the-box and roared out, "Silence, fore and aft! Silence, did you hear me?" with such extreme vehemence and indignation that the cackle stopped dead. And in the silence, Stephen made his way to the cabin. Jack was sitting behind the piles of papers usual in port, for a captain who was also his own purser, but his stern expression changed to a smile when the door opened and he said, "Why, there you are, Stephen. How glad I am to see you. We'd not looked for you until tomorrow. I hope you had a pleasant trip." "Very pleasant, I thank you. Blaxland did everything that was kind and hospitable. He desires his best compliments, by the way. And we saw the emu, various kinds of kangaroo, the echidna, good Lord, the echidna, the small, fat, grey animal that sleeps high up in gum trees and that very absurdly claims to be a bear. A great many of the parrot tribe, a nameless monitory lizard, all that we'd hoped to see and more, except for the platypus. An agreeable countryside, however, upon the whole." "Why, as for that, it's of the first interest to the botanist, and its animals fill one with joy and amazement. The economy of the echidna is scarcely to be believed. But as for countryside, I don't think I've seen anything so dismal or more like my idea of the plains of purgatory. Perhaps it may improve with rain. At present everything is parched. Even the stream between Botany Bay and here was dry. But, Jack, you look angrily." "I am angrily. I'm in fact so exceedingly out of temper that I can scarcely command my mind and keep it steady to its paperwork," said Jack. And Stephen, with a sinking heart, saw that he was, if anything, understating the case. "When Tom and I were away looking at some timber with chips, a party of soldiers came down here with two officers. They said there was an escaped convict aboard, and they insisted on looking for him at once without waiting for my return. They had a magistrate's warrant. Most of our people were on shore leave or away in the boats bringing stores. The party was strong and headed by a captain. West, who was in charge, no longer holds a commission, as you know, so what with that and with the likelihood of our being made to look ridiculous if we resisted, he confined himself to making the strongest possible protest, uttered before witnesses, and walked off the ship. They searched her. They had some old Sydney Cove hands with them, and they found the man almost at once. They marched him away, sobbing fit to break your heart, said little Reed, who met them as he was coming down from the town. You could recognise the man by the raw bloody places about his ankles where the irons had been. Was he a friend of some of our people? I'm sure he was, but of which there's no telling. No one's going to get himself or his shipmates into trouble, and if you ask questions, you'll only get that don't know, sir, with a glassy look to one side of your head I've heard aboard every ship I ever served in. But think of it, Stephen. To search a king's ship without a captain's permission, it's monstrous. It is indeed extraordinarily offensive. And then they tried to justify themselves by some miserable quibbling over the surprise's status. But I told them that they were as ignorant of naval law as they were of good manners, that a ship hired by His Majesty and commanded by one of his officers had all the rights of a man-of-war on the establishment, and I named the instances of Ariadne, Beaver, Hecate and Fly, which clapped a stopper over all. Jack, I hope and trust you didn't commit yourself. No. By King Charles, I don't want to go on my travels again. Lord, they were bitter travels, Stephen. And I kept as cool as a judge. Or as cool as a judge ought to be, he said, remembering a malignant, rambling, red-faced, ranting old fool at Guildhall in a judge's wig and gown. When you say they, do you mean the soldiers? No. It's the civilians. The people have been in the colony a long while and are well entrenched together with their allies. They're called the MacArthur clan, and they can make Colonel Macpherson sign any paper they put in front of him. The young fellow I sent away just now brought a note saying that to prevent any further unfortunate incident, the authorities intended placing sentries at the brows. A note Macpherson had had to put his name to and the unfortunate lieutenant had to bring. This is one of the reasons we're about to cast off fore and aft and warp out into the cove again. I'm damned if I walk in and out of my own ship between a couple of redcoats. But there is another reason too. He went on in a lower tone. That young fool Hopkins, main topman, starboard watch, smuggled a girl aboard last night, a ticket to leave Barmaid. By a great stroke of luck, West happened to hear her giggling in the cable tier, and we smuggled her ashore again in double-quick time unseen. Hopkins is in irons, and I shall have the hide off him as soon as we're warmed out. Oh, no, Jack, no more flogging in this horrible place, I beseech you. Eh? Ah, no, perhaps not. See what you mean. Come in, he cried. Reed, very grave, said, Captain Pulling's duty, sir, and all is laid along. Thank you, Mr. Reed, said Jack. My compliments to Captain Pullings, and I desire he'll carry on. A moment later, nautical cries broke out on the quarter-deck with the due responses fore and aft, the whole interspersed with the sound of bosun's calls, now sharp and cutting, now an eerie wail. The complex process of getting a ship underway with all its rituals. Jack's attention was fixed on the sequence of events, and during this time Stephen considered his face. The whites of his eyes were yellowish. His stern expression hadn't softened at all at the sight of Reed, as it usually did. And although he'd spoken with a good deal of anger, it was clear that there was a great deal more as yet unexpressed. Even more than most sailors, Jack resented any hint of disrespect to the service. This had been very gross, and it came in an atmosphere of evident ill will. The bars of the capstan had been shipped long since, and now it began turning, but with no great exertion, no fife or fiddle, only the sound of bare feet. The wharf slid gently aft, dwindling in size. The view from the scuttle opposite Stephen increased until Government House was within its frame. Then the frigate turned 8 points to starboard, and there was Government House once more, together with much of the settlement, in the broad sweep of the stern window. "I shall be glad to be out in the cove," said Jack. "Makes much more work, carrying and fetching, but even so. Stephen, you wouldn't believe how stupid, reckless and wanton seamen can be. Here's Hopkins with his wench immediately after that wretched business with the soldiers. But a moment's reflection would have told him that in the first place it was criminal on his part to bring her aboard at all, and secondly that it would put us all in the wrong. And I've little doubt that if we'd stayed tied up to the side, some other young fool would have been at it again. Or half a dozen fools, young or old, you wouldn't believe it. None of this was news to Stephen. He knew the consequences of a stay in port rather better than Jack, and the extraordinary lengths to which men would go to satisfy their desires. He knew that this urge was concentrated by months at sea, and perhaps by the injudicious diet. 6 pounds of meat a week, however indifferently preserved, was far too much. And even on the quarter-deck, where some degree of education might be expected to soften manners and inculcate restraint, he'd known officers risk a truly happy marriage in stupid, reckless and wanton fornication. This was no time to impart his knowledge to Jack, however. It wasn't even a time to ask him to put out his tongue and give an account of his entrails. After a while he said, "By the way, how are the little girls? I hope they've given no trouble." "They're very well indeed, I believe. And no trouble at all. I've seen nothing of them, almost. They never come on deck until after dark for fear of being seized, but I hear them singing down below." "And what of Paulton? Did you have any news of him while we were away?" "Oh, yes," said Jack, his face brightening somewhat. "He called to take leave some days ago. He has to go back to his cousin's place along the coast, not far from Bird Island. He hoped we would come to see him by boat, or, if that were impossible, that you would look in on him during your northern trip." "What a very agreeable evening we had with him, upon my word. Such a jovial companion, and such a hand with his violin. How glad I was I insisted upon playing second fiddle. Even so, he put me to the blush." News that the ship was moored came below, and presently Stephen said, "Jack, tomorrow I must wait on Mrs. Macquarie and try to make my excuses at last. But before that, before breakfast indeed, I should like to examine you to find whether your plethory is wholly digested and prescribe physic if it is not." "Very well. But I tell you what it is, Stephen. We sail on the 24th. Even if the governor's back by then, which I think very likely, and even if everything then goes more smoothly, which I think possible, I have decided to renounce some of the repairs and a sail with the change of the moon. I'm sorry if it cuts your journey short or interferes with your plans." "Not at all. I shall start a little earlier, tomorrow itself, perhaps. And unless we are devoured by some nondescript wild beast or get lost in the worst kind of bush, to which the labyrinth is child's play and the maze at Hampton Court an inconsiderable toy, we shall be back on the 23rd. I shall tell Padeen when we pass by Paulton's place." "What now?" called Jack, turning to the door. "Here's a damned thing, sir," cried Pullings. "The guards at South Point insisted on examining the blue cutter, tried to stop it. Oakes, who was in charge, said he'd blow out the brains of the first man that laid a hand on the gunwale. Quite right, too. The boat was wearing a jack." "Yes, sir." "That makes it more monstrous still. I shall report it to the Admiralty. I shall raise it in the House. Hell and death, they'll be opening my letters and dispatches next and sleeping in my cot." Once more, Stephen, brushed, dressed, shaved and powdered to the height of Killick's lofty standards, sent in his card. And this time, although Her Excellency was engaged, he was particularly desired to wait. She would be free in 5 minutes. The 5 minutes stretched out to 10, and the hall door opened to admit his cousin, James Fitzgerald, a somewhat worldly priest, nominally a member of the Fathers of the Faith, the Portuguese order. They looked at one another with a cat-like determination not to show surprise, but their greeting and their embrace was affectionate. They had, after all, spent many a happy day running about the Galtee Mountains together from the house of a grand-uncle common to both. They now exchanged some family news, worked out just when they'd last met, which was also in an anteroom, that of the Patriarch of Lisbon. And then James said, "Stephen, forgive me if I'm indiscreet, but I hear you may be going northward by way of Woolloowoolloo presently." "Do you, cuz?" And if that should be so, may I advise you to take great care. There is a band of absconders, United Irishmen, hard men, living between there and Newcastle, and some of them think you may have changed sides since 98. You were seen on the deck of an English ship that chased Gough into the Solway Firth, and after he'd been hanged, some of his friends were transported. But they cannot be men who ever knew me. I was always totally opposed to violence in Ireland, and I deplored the rising. I begged Cousin Edward not to use force. And even now, Catholic emancipation and the dissolution of the Union, Acts of Parliament no more, would deal with the situation. But Bonaparte's tyranny is something new in its kind, far, far more thorough and intelligent. And in this case, force is the only remedy. I am willing to help anyone to bring him down, and so, as I know very well, are you and your order. His success would be the ruin of Europe, his help fatal to Ireland, yet never, never, never in my life have I played the informer. Before Father Fitzgerald could reply, a footman came in and said, Dr. Maturin, sir, if you please. Dr. Maturin, said Mrs. Macquarie. I'm so very sorry to have kept you waiting. Poor Colonel Macpherson was with me in such a state of anxiety. She looked as though she were going to say more, but changing her mind, she asked Maturin to sit down and went on, Well, and so you've been travelling about in the bush. I hope you liked it. It was an exceedingly interesting experience, ma'am. We survived, thanks to an intelligent black, and we brought back an assload of specimens that will keep us busy for the next 12 months and more. But before I say anything else, allow me to make my most humble apologies for the behaviour of those wicked little girls. It was a truly wretched return for your kindness, and I blush at the recollection. It didn't altogether surprise me, I must confess. They were as wild as young hawks, poor little things, and even before they lost their heads, bit the matron, broke the window, and climbed down the outside of the house. How they managed not to break their legs as well, I cannot tell. They said they didn't like the company of girls, they far preferred being with men. Should you like to try again, perhaps? No, ma'am. Though I thank you very heartily, I don't think it would answer. And in any case, the ship's company would rise upon me. My solution, since I cannot restore them to their native island, now deserted, is to wrap them in wool and keep them below in the high southern latitudes, and in London to confide them to the care of an excellent motherly woman I've known these many years, who keeps an inn in the liberties of the Savoy, and who keeps it delightfully warm. They spoke of Mrs. Broad's qualities, and of the numbers of tropical blacks who became acclimatized to London. And then Mrs. Macquarie said, Dr. Maturin, may I speak to you quite unofficially about this present unhappy state of affairs? My husband will be back at last in a few days, and it would distress him even more than it distresses me. I should so like to make relations just a little better before he returns, if I possibly can. I am aware there has always been rivalry between the army and the navy here. You know the reasons better than I, since you were here in Admiral Bligh's time. But poor Colonel Macpherson is a newcomer, a stranger to it all, and is much concerned at having his letters returned as improperly addressed. As for the contents, he leaves that to the civilians, but he is a great stickler for forms, and it was with tears in his eyes that he showed me this cover, begging me to tell him if I could see the least impropriety in the direction. Stephen cocked his eye at the cover and said, Well, ma'am, I believe it is usual to add MP to the address of an officer who is also a member, to say nothing of FRS for one who belongs to the Royal Society, and JP if he's also a magistrate. But Captain Aubrey is not in the least punctilious, and he would never have taken the slightest notice of the omissions if he'd not been incensed by what looks very like ill-will, deliberate delay and frustration on the part of certain officials. He met it before, when his ship put in just after Governor Bligh's disagreement with Mr. MacArthur and his friends. Is Captain Aubrey a Member of Parliament? cried Mrs. Macquarie, startled into foolishness. Then, recovering herself, she uttered a low, gurgling laugh and said, Oh, there'll be some red ears among the civilians. They dread a question in Parliament worse than damnation. When Stephen rose to take his leave, she asked him whether he would dine informally tomorrow. Dr. Redfern would be there, and both he and she would like Mr. Maturin's opinion of their projected hospital. Alas, ma'am, said Stephen, at crack of dawn I am engaged to ride away towards the forests of the Hunter River, the home, I'm told, of the carpet snake and many a curious bird. Pray take care not to get lost, she said, giving him her hand. Almost everybody goes there by sea. And do let us know when you're back. I should like you to meet my husband, who's a great naturalist. In spite of Mrs. Macquarie's warning, they got lost on their first afternoon. The fairly broad track, for they were not yet beyond the range of scattered settlements, having led over an almost bare sandstone rise which gave them a view of lagoons, a complexity of lagoons, sloped gently down through scrub and scattered trees. And on the right hand they heard a full-throated liquid note of what could only be a lyrebird. A fairly distant lyrebird. "Do you know," said Stephen, "that no competent anatomist has ever examined one?" "I know it well," said Martin, his eye gleaming. They left the track and rode gently through the brush towards the often repeated note until they came to an acacia where they nodded, silently dismounted, tethered the horses and the ass — they'd brought him too, their journey being advanced — and walked as quietly as they could into the bush, Stephen carrying the fowling piece, for Martin, with only one eye and an unduly tender heart, was not a reliable shot. As quietly as they could. But the bush was close set, dry, littered with dead horny leaves, twigs, branches, and it grew deeper. They were within 50 yards of the voice when it stopped in mid-phrase. They waited, poised a good 10 minutes, and they were turning disappointed, resigned faces to one another when two other birds began. To approach the nearest, they had to creep, for not only had the brush changed to yet another kind of eucalypt, but the ground had also grown rocky. Still, they were experienced bird creepers, and now, with infinite pains, and accompanied, they being in the shade, by innumerable mosquitoes, they did get close enough to the bird to hear him chuckling to himself between his calls and scratching the ground. And when at last they came out into the little bald place with a mound in the middle where he'd been doing so, they found his mark and his droppings. This was their nearest approach to success. And after the seventh bird, they decided that so late in the day it was folly to go farther from their horses. They would return to the acacia where they were tethered. "But surely this isn't the way," cried Martin. "We had the great lagoon directly before us when we left the road." "I have the compass," said Stephen. "The compass cannot lie." After a while the compass, or their interpretation of it, led them through a prickly shrub they'd never seen before and whose botanical nature they couldn't determine. They were following what seemed to be a path made by the repeated passage of some animal when Martin stopped abruptly. Turning, he said, "Here's a dead man." He was an escaping convict, and had been speared a week or 10 days before. At least they laid a symbolic branch over him before they walked on, forced to make some detours because of stretches of impenetrable bush, but still rising and hoping for more open country. It was when the sun was as low as their hearts and they stood there in doubt, with lyrebirds calling on either hand, that they heard the ass's howl, not a quarter of a mile behind them. In their agitation they had managed to cross the track without seeing it, and once they were on it again the whole landscape fell into place, direction was obvious, and the great lagoon lay where it ought to lie in relation to the rest. They woke to the sweetest dawn. Day in the east, still night in the west, and a sky between them varying by imperceptible degrees from violet to the purest aquamarine. Dew had fallen, and the still air was full of scents unknown to the rest of the world. The horses moved companionably about, smelling gently of horse. The ass was still asleep. Smoke rising straight, the smell of coffee. "Have you ever known a more blessed day?" asked Martin.
"I have not," said Stephen.
"Even this uninviting landscape is transfigured." A lyrebird called on the hillside within 20 yards, and while their cups were still poised it flew right over their heads, a long-tailed pheasant-like creature, and pitched in the brush beyond. The horses brought their ears to bear. The ass woke up.
"Should you like to pursue him?" asked Stephen.
"No," said Martin. "We've seen one now. And if we want to dissect one, Poulton will, I'm sure, oblige us with a specimen. They send dogs in to flush them and shoot them as they rise. I am of opinion that we should never deviate from the track and devote all our time to the waders. There must be hosts of them on the lagoons, together with what ducks the country can afford. And as Poulton said, the track skirts the whole series." There were, indeed, hosts of waders on the shore, long-legged birds stalking about in the water, short-legged ones racing about on the mud, formations 1,000 strong wheeling all together with a flash of wings, and everywhere those fluting marsh and shorebird cries, often the same as those they'd both heard in their boyhood, and uttered by birds, if not of quite the very species, then wonderfully like greenshanks, stilts, avocets, plovers of every kind. "And there's an oyster catcher," said Martin. "I cannot tell you, Matchalin, how happy I am to be lying here on the saltwort in the sun, watching that oyster catcher through my glass. He is so like ours that I'm puzzled to say just where the difference lies," said Stephen. "But he's certainly not quite our bird." "Why," said Martin, "he has no white on his primaries." "Of course," said Stephen, "and his bill is surely longer by an inch. Yet I believe it's not the difference that makes me so happy, but rather the similarity. This happiness, which inhabited both of them, received something of a check when the path, which had run by 3 successive bodies of water without ambiguity, divided into 2 equally faint arms on the grassy slope of a hill that separated the 3rd body from the 4th, a grassy slope with a spring. They dismounted to let the horses drink and graze, and to consider the interminable complexity of shining water that stretched away and away before them under the vast bowl of sky, with clouds sailing across it on the southeast trade. They could come to no satisfactory conclusion, giving the horses their heads in the hope that instinct would succeed where reason failed didn't answer. The horses gazed at them with patient, stupid faces and waited to be told where to go. The ass remained perfectly indifferent. So it was decided by the toss of a coin that they should take the right-hand arm. And after all, they said, even if it should die away, as paths so often did, so long as they kept down to the water's edge, they couldn't get lost in the dreadful bush, since there was no bush down there. And so long as they kept generally northward along the coast, they must necessarily come to Woolloo Woolloo. Eased in their minds, they gathered several of the more unusual plants. The habitat was in itself most exceptional. Some beetles, and the almost perfect skeleton of a bandicoot, and rode on, startling a group of kangaroos when they came round the shoulder of the slope. The theory on which they proceeded was sound, but it didn't make quite enough allowance for the winding of the shores along which they travelled, nor for the fact that many of the lagoons were not lagoons at all, but deep and many-branched inlets of the sea. The path, of course, disappeared on an outcrop of bare sandstone, never to be found again. Could it have been made by kangaroos, they wondered. But they carried on happily enough, plagued by mosquitoes early and late, but enchanted by the birds, until both food and time began to run out. An incautious kangaroo, upwind in a misty dawn, an ancient, tall, grey kangaroo, perhaps senile, provided food of a sort, but nothing could provide them with time And when at last they found Wulu Wulu, which they did from the seaward side of the lagoon, recognising it with immense relief, their theory justified, ignominious death averted, by the cairn and flagpost that Paulton had described, and Bird Island just showing in the north, they couldn't stay more than that night with him, in spite of his pleas, still less press on to the forests of the Hunter Valley. "My dear sir," said Stephen, "you are very good, but we've almost outstayed our leave. I've promised Captain Aubrey to be back on the 23rd, and with our horses in their present state and the ass so slow, we must start very early tomorrow. If you would do me a kindness, you would see us on our way until even a very stupid fellow cannot miss the track." "Of course I will," said Paulton, and he went on. "Your cattle are being rubbed down and pampered at this moment by two dealers from Newmarket itself. Great hands at preparing a horse." Observing his discretion, Stephen said, "May I ask you to show me the fruit trees you have in front of the house?" In the orchard, where some apple trees were growing in a strange left-handed fashion, filled with incongruous cicadas and still bewildered by the reversal of the seasons, Paulton said, "I wish I were capable of expressing my sense of your kindness in this matter of my tale. It means freedom for me." "You expressed yourself very handsomely in your letter," said Stephen, "far more handsomely indeed than ever could be looked for, and I beg you will say no more, but rather tell me of Padeen Coleman." "I think you'll be pleased with him," said Paulton with a smile. "He came skin and bone, though that good man Redfern had almost healed his back. He came, by the way, labelled Patrick Walsh, which is, I take it, the registry clerk's way of covering their traces and confusing the issues to a hopeless degree, and he's been eating ever since. I've let it be known that he's infectious, and I've put him by himself in the lamb pasture hut. If you'd come up the stream from the lagoon, you would have seen it. May I lead you there now?" "If you please." The meadow was true meadow, the largest stretch of grass that Stephen had seen in New South Wales. It was scattered with thick lambs, some of whom still gambolled heavily, and in the middle stood a cabin built of sods and thatched with reeds, the roof held down against the wind by stone-weighted lines. The reeds came from the beds at the far end of the meadow, where the stream ran into the lagoon, forming the little bay where the settlement's produce was shipped to Sydney. In front of the cabin sat Padeen, singing about Concaith Cahach to two young aborigines, standing there tall and thin before him. "I dare say you'd like to speak to him," said Paulton. "I shall go back and stir up the cook." "It'll not take me 5 minutes," said Stephen. "I shall say no more than that I may be at the mouth of the stream in a boat on the 24th, or 2 or 3 days later in case of bad weather, but never before noon. Brief I shall be. I don't wish to disturb his spirits, they've been so sadly racked." It didn't take him so long. But in that time it was clear to his companions that his own spirits too had been much affected. "Those black youths," he said sternly as they sat down to their infinitely welcome meal, "those black youths that ran away when I came near, do they belong to the place at all?" "Oh, no," said Paulton. "They come and go as they choose in their wandering way of life. But there are nearly always a few of them in the neighbourhood. My cousin will not have them ill-used or their women debauched. He has a kindness for them. Sometimes gives them a sheep or, what they very much prefer, a cauldron of sweetened rice. He's trying to compile a vocabulary of their language, but since they appear to possess at least 10 synonyms for everything, all of many syllables, while he has a most indifferent ear, the list makes little progress." They talked at random about the remarkable butterflies they'd seen all the way, particularly along the last lagoon, and their lack of a net left behind at Riley's, about the curved throwing stick seen at the same place, about the aborigines. And at one point Paulton said, "Do you really think they're intelligent?" "If intelligence can be defined as an ability to solve problems, they're intelligent."
said Stephen, for surely the very first problem is to keep alive. And in such a disinherited country as this, the problem is enormous. Yet they have solved it. I could not. Nor I, said Bolton. But would your definition bear close inspection? Perhaps not. In any case, I'm far too stupid to defend it. Oh, dear, cried Bolton, you must both be dropping with weariness. May I recommend a warm bath before you retire? The coppers will be on the boil by now, and as far as my experience goes, there's nothing more relaxing for body or for mind. I'm afraid we were but dismal guests, said Stephen, turning in his saddle to wave across the scrub to the disappearing Bolton, who chose this same moment to look back and wave before disappearing down the slope and into the tall bush. And even this morning I was somewhat chuff. I particularly wished to prevent him committing himself, so that he could always assert that he was not a party to my actions. Morally, he couldn't possibly do so. He knows perfectly well what we're about. I mean legally. In the foolish rigour of the foolish law, I wish him to be able to put his name to an affidavit that says Matcherly never said this to me, and I never said the other to Matcherly. Do you think that could conceivably be a Peregrine? I believe so, said Martin, shading his eye, a Tearsall. Lewin said they occur in New Holland. That bird, said Stephen, watching the falcon out of sight, is as great a comfort to me as your oyster catcher was to you. Then, returning to Bolton, what a good-natured man he is, to be sure. It's a pleasure to be in his company. I only wish his sight would allow him to distinguish a bird from a bat. Perhaps if we were given a microscope, a good compound microscope with a variety of eyepieces and an ample stage, he might take great pleasure in some of the smaller forms, the rhizopods, the rotifera, the parasites of lice themselves. I knew an old gentleman, an Anglican parson, who delighted in mites. Now that their wisdom was wholly superfluous, the track being almost a carriage road, the mares looked quite intelligent, stepping out with a confident pace for their distant stable, so briskly that, in spite of several stops for botanizing and shooting parrots and bush birds, they reached Newbury's, an inn on a drover's road some way north of the Woolloo Woolloo track, with daylight and to spare. It was in this daylight that Stephen saw the boomerang at last. A dissolute black, wrecked by his contact with the whites, but still retaining his skill, threw it for a tot of rum. The boomerang did all that Riley had said of it, and more. At one point, having returned, it rose and floated above the aboriginal's head in a slow circle before descending into his hand. Stephen and Martin gazed at the object in astonishment, turning it over and over in their hands. "I cannot understand the principle at all," said Stephen. "I should very much like to show it to Captain Aubrey, who is so very well versed in the mathematics and dynamics of sailing. Landlord, pray ask him whether he's willing to part with the instrument." "Not on your fucking life," said the Aboriginal, snatching the boomerang and clasping it to his bosom. "He says he doesn't choose to dispose of it, Your Honour," said the landlord, "but never fret. I have a dozen behind the bar that I sell to ingenious travellers for half a guinea. Choose anyone that takes your fancy, sir, and Bennelong will throw it to prove it comes back. A true homing pigeon, as we say." "Won't you?" This much louder in the black man's ear. "Won't I what? Throw it for the gentleman. Give him dram. Sir, he says he'll be happy to throw it for you, and hopes you'll encourage him with a tot of rum." In the clear morning, much refreshed, they rode on. Stephen with a genuine homing pigeon across his saddlebow, Martin with a variety of cloth bags full of specimens attached to his, for the ass was already overloaded. As they dropped down towards Port Jackson, the number and variety of parrots and their discordant noise increased. Cockatoos in flocks, cockatiels, lories, and clouds of budgerigars. And when they first looked down into Sydney Cove, they saw no frigate moored there where they'd left her. This is the 23rd, isn't it? Asked Stephen. I believe so, said Martin. I'm almost sure that yesterday was the 22nd. They both knew Captain Aubrey's iron rigour where the time of sailing was concerned, and it was with a more than usual anxiety that they gazed at the empty cove. But there goes our launch, passing South Point, said Stephen, his spyglass to his eye. I can see it has a flag in front. And there is the ship, tied up against the side where we used to be, cried Martin, joy and relief overflowing. And there's another one, tied up just behind it. An even larger vessel. I have a feeling it may be the long-foretold ship from Madras, said Stephen. This impression was much strengthened as they came into the town, where tight-turbaned Lascars could be seen contemplating the iron gangs with satisfaction, and where strange uniforms walked about the streets, staring as newcomers stare. They rode straight to Riley's now crowded tavern, and while Stephen prepared to settle accounts with the landlord, Martin went down to the ship with two blackguard boys wheeling a handcart loaded with their specimens. Riley, who knew everything, told Stephen that the Waverley had indeed come from Madras, but that she brought no official packages from India, still less any overland civilian mail. But this was no real disappointment, since she'd never been expected to do so. She had, however, brought out a number of officers. And Stephen sat in the parlour, more or less filled with them, until Riley should be free to deal with the horses. As he sat there, gazing at the tavern's boomerang and trying to find some plausible reason for its behaviour, he became aware that one of the officers, a Royal Marine near the doorway, was looking at him with more than ordinary attention. He reflected upon the perception of eyes focused upon one, the gaze felt even when the gazer was outside one's field of vision, the uneasiness it caused, an uneasiness felt by many creatures, the importance of not looking directly at one's quarry, the exchange of glances between the sexes, its infinite variety of meanings. And he was still reflecting when the officer came over and said, Dr. Maturin, I believe. Yes, sir, said Stephen, reserved, but not repulsively so. You'll not remember me, sir, being so busy at the time, but you was good enough to save my leg after Somare's action in the gut. My name is Hastings. Certainly, a patella I remember perfectly. Sir William Hastings, is it not? May I roll up your trouser leg? Oh, yes, yes, beautifully knit, and that scoundrelly charlatan would have had it off. To be sure, a neat amputation's always a pleasure, but even so... And now you have a perfectly sound limb rather than a peg. Very good, patting its calf gently. I give you joy of it. And I give you joy too, Doctor. You're very good, Sir William. Do you allude to the patella? No, sir. To your daughter. But perhaps you don't think that a subject for congratulation. I'm aware that there is a prejudice against daughters. Portions, wedding breakfasts, vapours and so on. I beg your pardon. I have not the pleasure of following you, sir, said Stephen, looking at him with his head on one side, but his heart beginning to beat faster. Well, no doubt I mistake, but when I was in Madras, Andromache came in. One of our officers lent me a naval chronicle, and running through the promotions, births, deaths and marriages, my eye caught what I took to be your name, though perhaps it was another gentleman altogether. Sir William, what was the month and what did it say? As far as I recall, it was last April, and it said, at Ashgrove Cottage near Portsmouth, the lady of Dr. Maturin of the Navy, of a daughter. Sweet Sir William, said Stephen, shaking his hand. You couldn't have brought me kinder, more welcome news. Riley there, do you hear me now? Bring us the finest bottle that ever you have at the house. Riley's finest bottle had no effect on Stephen. Joy alone brought him skipping across the brow to the frigate's deck. a careworn deck with what looked like the whole ship's company busy upon it, though this couldn't have been the case, seeing that a great many hands were banging away far aft amidst the sound of echoing orders. While he was gazing about at the decorations, the bunting, the meticulous coiling of ropes, Captain Aubrey appeared, accompanied by Reed with a tape measure in his only hand. Jack was looking thinner, yellower, and worried. But he smiled and said, "Are you back, Doctor? Mr. Martin tells me you had a splendid time." "So we did too," said Stephen. "But, Jack, I cannot tell you with what eagerness I look forward to going home." "I dare say you do, so do I. Mr. Oakes," directing his powerful voice at the fore-to-gallant mast, "is that garland to be shipped this watch, or should you like your hammock sent aloft?" "Now, Doctor, we are about to give the Governor and his people a farewell dinner. That's the cause of all this mediment. You'll have time to change, but I'm afraid Killick will not be able to give you a hand. He's busier than any hive of bees. Mr. Reed, hold the tape exactly there, and don't stir until I give you a hail." With this he hurried aft, where all three cabins were being thrown into one, and the harassed carpenter was fitting still another leaf to the table. Although at this moment his wits were not at their sharpest, Stephen grasped the situation. The unnatural cleanliness of all hands, the more than ordinary brilliance of everything that sand or brick dust could induce to shine, the widespread and deep anxiety that was usual before naval entertainments on a grand scale, which, in his experience, were prepared as though all the guests were old, experienced seamen, censorious, hostile admirals, likely to inspect the blacking of the highest yards and look for dust under the carronade slides. He went to his cabin below, his mind still somewhat confused by happiness, and found that, in spite of everything, Killick had laid out all the clothes that were proper for him to wear. He slowly dressed, taking particular care of the set of his coat, and came out into the gunroom, where he found Pullings sitting carefully in the gold-laced splendour of a commander. "Why, Doctor," he said, his face brightening, "how happy I am to see you back. You look as gay as a popinjay, as cheerful as if you'd found a five-pound note. I hope you brought the poor old barkie some good luck at last. God love us, what a week! You look as if you'd been through a fleet action, Tom. I may smile again when we sail tomorrow afternoon and when we've sunk the land, but not before. You'd think the hands conspired to put us in the wrong and to give the surprise a bad name. Drunken seaman, paralytic, brought out by lobsters with kind advice on how to keep them in order. Awkward bloody Davies locked up for beating two sentries into a jelly and throwing their muskets into the sea. They tried to stop him taking a girl out in a boat. And Jack Nastyface did bring a girl out. Being so thick with the cook, he brought her aboard in broad daylight, wrapped up like a side of bacon. He kept her in the forepeak and fed her like a fighting cock through the scuttle. And when he was found, he said she wasn't an ordinary young woman at all. He wanted to marry her, which would make her free, and would the captain be so kind? 'By all means,' says the captain, 'and then you can take your wages and go ashore with her. The ship don't carry wives.' So Jack Nastyface thought better of his bargain. She went ashore alone, and now all the people despise him. And there was another poor devil swam out. Several other things. Lord, how I prayed for a party of marines. The bloody-minded officials had eased off before the Governor came back, but by then Jacks had pretty well destroyed our case and reputation. And although things are smoothed over now and we're tied up alongside again, I don't think there's much love lost between ship and shore. I've never known the captain more worn, nor more apt to grow, well, testy, you might say. Four bells. Now, Doctor," Pullings went on, "it's time for me to throw an eye over all, and perhaps for you to put on your breeches." "God save you, Tom," cried Stephen, looking with concern at his pale, bony knees. "I'm so glad you noticed it. My mind must have wandered. I should have got the ship a worse name still." When Stephen was breeched, he sat at his folding desk and wrote to Diana, his pen scratching away at an extraordinary speed, the sheets of paper mounting on his cot. "If you please, sir," said Reed at the door, "the captain thinks you might like to know that our guests are underway from Government House." "Thank you, Mr. Reed," said Stephen. "I shall be with you as soon as I've finished this paragraph." He was on deck just before the first gun of the Governor's salute,
and he observed with gratification, but not much surprise, that the half-fledged anxious ship he'd last seen was now a serene man-of-war, confident that her yards were squared by lifts and braces to within an eighth of an inch, and that her guests could eat off any part of any one of her decks. In fact, they ate off the full extent of Jack Aubrey's silver, the baize-lined chests being empty but for a pair of broken sugar tongs. And from behind the captain's chair, Killick surveyed his triumph with whole-hearted delight, a look that sat strangely on a face set in shrewish discontent. The guests filed in, and Stephen found that he was to sit between Dr. Redfern and Firkins, the penal secretary. "How very glad I am that we're neighbours," he said to Redfern. "I was afraid that after our few words on the quarter-deck we should be torn apart." "So am I," said Redfern. "And when you consider this table, we could easily be out of earshot. Heavens, I've never seen such magnificence in a frigate, nor such a sweep of cloth." "Nor have I," said Firkins, and in a low tone to Stephen. "Surely Captain Aubrey must be a gentleman of very considerable estate." "Oh, very considerable indeed," said Stephen, "and he also commands, I know not how many votes, in both the Commons and the Lords. He's much caressed by the Ministry." He added a few more details to sadden Firkins, but only a few, since his heart was aswim with joy, and he spent most of his meal, and nearly all the prolonged port and then coffee, drinking in conversation with Redfern. The surgeon was no great naturalist. Asked, for example, whether he'd seen the platypus, he looked doubtful. "The more modern name is Ornithorhynchus," said Stephen. "Yes, yes, I know the animal," said Redfern. "I've often heard it spoken of. It's not uncommon, and I was trying to remember whether, in fact, I'd seen it or not. Probably not. Here, by the way, it's called the water mole. The learned names wouldn't be understood." Yet, on the other hand, he could tell Stephen a great deal about the behaviour of men to one another in New South Wales and the still more dreadful Norfolk Island, where he'd spent some time. The usual but not invariable response to absolute power and the absence of public opinion. So taken up was Stephen with his conversation and with his inner happiness that he scarcely noticed how the party was going. But when he returned from seeing Dr. Redfern back to the hospital and giving his opinion on a hydroseal, he said to Jack, sitting alone in the reconstituted great cabin and drinking a tankard of barley water, "How very well that went off. A most successful dinner." "I'm glad you think so. I found it devilish heavy going, worked like a horse, and I was afraid other people thought so too." "Not at all, at all. Never in life, my dear. Jack, before coming aboard today, I met a man from the Madras ship." "Oh, but before I forget, is this southeast breeze to be relied on?" "Lord, yes, it's been blowing these 10 days together and the glass has never moved." "Then please, may I have a cutter early in the morning and may I be picked up off Bird Island?" "Of course," said Jack, waving his empty tankard. "And should you like some of this barley water?" "If you please," said Stephen. "Killick! Killick there!" called Jack. And when he came, "Two more cans of barley water, Killick, and let Bondon know the doctor wants the blue cutter at 3 bells in the morning watch." "Two cans and 3 bells it is, sir," said Killick, aiming for the door. "Two cans, 3 bells. He struck the jam a shrewd blow. He was usually drunk after a dinner party, but he got through upright. "What do you expect to find on Bird Island?" "No doubt there are petrels, but I don't think of landing there, alas, with so little time to spare." "Then what are you going for?" "Am I not to pick up Padeen?" "Of course you're not to pick up Padeen." "But, Jack, I told you I should warn him. I told you before Martin and I set off, when you said we were to sail on the 24th. I have warned him, and he'll be waiting there on the strand." "I certainly didn't understand anything of the kind. Stephen, I've had endless trouble with convicts trying to escape,
The officials have harassed and badgered me for that reason, among others, and have stinted my stores, supplies and repairs, and to avoid anything really ugly, I had to warp out into the bay, which delayed everything still farther. When the governor came back, I went to see him and stated the case as fairly as I could. He admitted that searching the ship without my consent was improper and asked whether I desired an apology. I said no, but that if he would give me an undertaking that nothing of the kind would happen again, I, for my part, should undertake that no convict would leave Sydney Cove in my ship, and so leave the matter there. He agreed, and we warped in. "We're speaking of a shipmate, Jack. I'm committed." "So am I. In any case, how can you ask the captain of a king's ship to do such a thing? I'll make every possible representation in Padine's favour, but I will not countenance a convict's escape. I've turned several away already." "Is that what I'm to say to Padine?" "My hands are tied. I've given the governor my word. It would be said that I was abusing my authority as a post-captain and my immunity as a member." Stephen looked at him for some time, weighing the value of any reply. The look conveyed, or was thought to convey, something of pity and contempt, and it stung Jack extremely. He said, "You've brought this on yourself." Stephen turned, and seeing Killick with the tankards, he took one, said, "Thank you, Killick," and carried it below. Davidge was sitting in the gunroom. He told him that Martin was down among the specimens, putting the bird skins into the brine tub, and he went on, "What a wretched dinner that was, upon my word. I'm sure that Jack Nastyface, being so disgruntled, poured salt in by the ladle, and anyway, the civilians were like a set of funeral mutes. I tried as hard as I could, but they wouldn't be pleased. I dare say it was the same at your end of the table. No wonder you look hipped." "Martin," said Stephen when he reached the storeroom and the smell of feathers, "it appears that there's been a misunderstanding and that I may not take Padine aboard. I'm not quite sure what I shall do. However, the boat will be ready at 3 bells in the morning watch. Would you care to come with me? I ask because at dinner Dr. Redfern told me that the colonial name for the platypus is water mole, which I didn't know when your friend Poulton told us that water moles lived in the Wooloo Wooloo stream. This might be your last chance of seeing one." "Thank you very much," said Martin, looking into his face by the lantern light and quickly turning away. "I shall be ready at 3 bells. Stephen asked for a hand to get at his chest, took out a fair sum in gold and notes, locked it again, gave Martin the key and said, "If I should not return to the ship tomorrow, will you be so good as to have this sent to my wife?" "Of course," said Martin. I don't think I have ever felt such strong and conflicting emotions in my life, he reflected, walking out of Sydney on the Parramatta Road. His intention was to diminish their force by walking far and fast. Physical weariness, he'd found before, could do away with subsidiary aspects, such as in this case mere exasperation, and after some hours the right course of action would appear. Yet in the hours he walked now, nothing of the kind took place. His mind perpetually dropped the problem and flew back to his happiness, his present and future happiness. He walked a great way in the darkness, and that part of his mind which was free to be astonished was astonished by the number of nocturnal animals he heard and occasionally saw in the faint moonlight, and they so near the settlement. Phalangers, bandicoots, a koala, wombats. As for Jack, he said, his hero Nelson wouldn't have acted so. But Nelson wasn't a righteous man. He had no sudden rush of virtue to the head. Middle age has come upon Jack Aubrey at last, a creature I'd never thought it would. He said this without rancour, as one stating a fact, but he also said, one of the great advantages of wealth is that you're not obliged to eat toads. You can do what you think right. The question of what he thought right in these circumstances wasn't solved by the time the moon set, and he turned back. His consideration of the problem was often interrupted by actions of grace. one of which, a plain chant thanksgiving he'd often heard at Montserrat before the French sacked, desecrated and destroyed the monastery, took him a mile and a half to sing. It wasn't solved by the time he reached the ship, footsore and wet from a shower out of the southeast, nor yet when, after a troubled waking night, he heard Bondon's discreet voice in his ear telling him the cutter was alongside. Joy revived, and sorrow with it. He dressed, tiptoed into the gunroom not to wake the other officers, murmured a good morning to Martin, and drank a cup of coffee. The cutter's masts were already stepped, and as he made his way down into it, Stephen noticed with satisfaction that the crew were all old shipmates, men-of-war's men. Bondon, who had no notion of the doctor's common sense, whatever his book learning might be, nor of Mr. Martin's, had provided boat cloaks against the keen night air, and he said, "Now, wait away, sir, if you please. Do you know Bird Island?" "Yes, sir. Saw it as we were coming in, and Captain Pullings took a fix on it." "Well, now, before that island, there's a point 2 or 3 miles to the south. And south again of that point, on the flat coast, there is the entrance to a lagoon marked by a flagstaff and a cairn. That is where we must go. How long do you think it'll take?" "With the breeze on the quarter, sir, we should be there by noon, easy. Shove off a forejoe." By the time they'd sailed down the long harbour, dawn was just beginning to break. A dawn so pure and exquisite that even Joe Place, who had seen 10,000 of them at sea, looked at it with mild approval, and Martin clasped his hands. Stephen saw nothing of it. He was asleep, wrapped in the boat cloak. The cutter passed the headlands, met the wide-spaced waves of the open sea, made a little offing close-hauled, and then steered northeast, which changed the boat's motion to a corkscrew roll of the kind that may make even hardened seamen uneasy if they've been ashore for some while. Stephen slept on. He slept on when the surface ripple caused by the changing tide brought spray sweeping diagonally across. Martin arranged the cloak to cover Stephen's head, and seeing that he wasn't easily to be woken, said to Bondon in a low tone, "We're going at a fine pace." "Yes, sir," said Bondon. "We shall have time and to spare, and I should stand off the shore to keep the doctor a little drier, only I'm afraid of missing the flagstaff." "Do you think we're near?" asked Stephen, suddenly awake. "Well, sir, I reckon we can't be a great way off." "Then as soon as we raise Bird Island, I shall watch the shore with my glass. And as for getting wet, the sun will soon dry us. It's much higher than I'd expected, and exceptionally warm." So they sailed on, the hands forward, talking quietly, the boat all alive with the breeze, the sun climbing until cool spray was welcome, and cloaks were laid aside. "There's your island, sir," said Bondon. And on the rise, Stephen saw it clear, nicking the horizon beyond the point. "So it is," he said. And both he and Martin took out their telescopes. Steadily the low, sandy coast filed by, and presently they agreed that this part or that might be familiar. Yet from the sea one dune, or even one clump of stunted trees, looks very like another, and there was no certainty until once again, and with something of the same relief, they saw the flagstaff and its cairn. "And it's not yet 11 o'clock," said Stephen. "I'm afraid I've roused you men from your hammocks too early."
"Never you mind us, sir," said Place with a chuckle. "We should have been swabbing decks, else this is more like a picnic, as they say."
Bondon steered for the opening. To his surprise, Stephen was able to tell him that there was a fathom of water over the bar at the lowest tide, and a deeper passage with the cairn and the flagstaff in a line bearing due east. He took the cutter through the moderate flurry of breaking waves along the entrance into the quiet waters of the lagoon, and so to the stage where the Woolloo Woolloo harvest was brought down to the brig. "Now, Bondon," said Stephen, "make a fire. You've brought your dinner, sure."
"Yes, sir. And Killick put up this parcel of sandwiches for you and Mr. Martin."
"Very good. Make a fire, then. Eat your dinner, and go to sleep in the sun, if you like. The ship is to pick us up off Bird Island this evening." I may not come down, but Mr. Martin will, not later than 2 or 1/2 past, and let nobody stray. There may be venomous creatures in these reeds. There were certainly butterflies, some of the same kinds that they'd seen before, others larger and still more spectacular. And as they walked up along the stream through the reeds and bushes, they netted several. But the extreme contradiction of spirit was still as strong on Stephen as ever, the ebullient joy and the wound. And his heart wasn't in it, nor was Martin's. Stephen, though never loquacious, was rarely as silent as this. The mood was catching. They passed through the reed bed to the firm ground and the open air, the vast sky of the meadow. The stream was on their left hand, whereas on their first visit it had been on their right, and they'd crossed it much higher up. "We're in a new part of the pasture," observed Stephen. "I can just make out the cabin a good 1/2 mile farther off than I'd expected. Lambs, a flight of whiter cockatoos, far over, a drift of smoke. We might walk a furlong or so along the stream," he went on. "We're much too early." In time of flood, the stream was clearly 10 or 15 yards in breadth, with deep-cut banks. But there'd been no flood for some years, and now they were covered with a fair number of bushes and tall, soft grass growing between them, while the stream itself, winding through the meadow, was no more than a stride across, a rivulet connecting a series of pools. The first of these pools had some interesting plants, which they collected, and a millipede. At the second, Martin, who was ahead on the path, whispered, "Oh, my God!" stopped, stepped cautiously back. "There they are," he whispered in Stephen's ear. They crept along the top of the bank, foot by foot, bent, so that when they raised their heads and peered through the fringe of leaves and reed plumes, they could just command the surface of the pool. The platypuses took no notice. They'd been swimming round and round when first Martin saw them. They went on swimming round and round, one after the other, in a broad ring, lost and absorbed in their ritual. They both swam low, surprisingly low, in the water, but the light struck the surface at such an angle that for the watchers there was no reflection. They could see everything below, from that scarcely believable duck's bill to the broad, flattened tail with the 4 webbed feet between them. Presently Stephen whispered, "I believe we can creep nearer still." Martin nodded, and with infinite caution they edged slanting down the side, Stephen steadying himself with the handle of the net. It was inch by inch now, each bush, each young tree, each tuft of grass, very carefully negotiated. At water level the going was easier, and they carried on their serpentine approach to the soft, damp mud of the pool shore itself, each behind a clump of rushes, peering through the shaded gap between them. As he'd done when he was a boy, reaching a point within hand's touch of a cock capercaillie calling and displaying in the spring, Stephen closed his mouth, so that the sound of his heart, loud in his throat like a hoarse old clock, shouldn't be heard. He might have left it open. The platypuses were wholly given over to their dance. Stephen and Martin sat there, easy on the yielding ground, watching, noting, comparing. And still the platypuses turned. Their ring took them far out, over to the other side, where the sun showed their fine brown perfectly, and it brought them in towards the shadow, quite close to the rushes. A laughing jackass called, and under the din Stephen said, "I'm going to try to catch one." Slowly, slowly he sank the net when they were at their farthest turn. Slowly, slowly he edged it out into the pool, under their invariable path. Twice he let them pass over it,
The third time he raised the leading edge just in front of the second, the pursuing animal. It dived instantly, but into the net. He stepped through the rushes, waist-deep into the pool, trusting neither the handle nor the stuff with so much weight, and with great strides he waded to the bank, his shining face turned to Martin and his gentle hand feeling into the purse. Warm, soft, wet fur and a strongly beating heart. "I mean you no harm, my dear," he said, and instantly he felt a piercing stab. A shocking pain ran up his arm. He scrambled to the bank, dropped the net, sat down, looked at his arm, bare, shirt-sleeved arm, and saw a puncture with a livid, swollen line already running up from wrist to elbow. "Take care, Martin," he said. "Put it back. Knife. Handkerchief." He cut deep and twisted the tourniquet hard, but already there was a stiffness in his throat and his voice was growing thick. He lay back in the mud and explained that he had known similar idiosyncratic cases, a bee sting, a scorpion, even a large spider, several cases. Some survived, some did not, over in a day, one way or the other. But there, hanging over him, was Padine's anguished face, and Paulton was saying, oh dear, Martin, I thought a naturalist would know the male has a poisonous spur. Oh dear, he's swelling, he's turning blue. "A poisonous spur?" asked Stephen through his pain, hoarse, unrecognisable. "The male? Alone? And all the whole class of mammalia?" The more or less coherent, rational hurry of words stopped because the power of speech left him, and presently the power of sight. Yet he was still present, though at a great distance, and not in darkness, though he could see nothing, but rather in a deep, violet world that reminded him of a previous state when, surprised by grief and an involuntary overdose of laudanum, he had plunged right down the inside of a lofty tower in Sweden. In this state, too, he could hear the remote voices of his friends, but now the hallucinations were absent or benign. The voice he particularly heard was Paulton's, who seemed oppressed by guilt, and who explained again and again that everyone at Woolloo Woolloo knew that you had to take great care of the water mole. By warning cries and vivid signs, the black man had said, "Touch him not." He'd seen a European dog die within minutes. He blamed himself extremely for not having mentioned the danger, had supposed it was common knowledge. "How can you speak so, Nathaniel?" said Martin. "No more than two or three dried, shrivelled, imperfect specimens were ever seen in London, and those only female." "How I regret it," said Paulton, "how bitterly I regret it." There were gaps, not so much in Stephen's consciousness as in his perception of things, and after one such blank or pause, it was Bondon he heard, telling Padine to "lift his head easy, mate, and lay it on my shoulder. Never mind the blood." A strong voice said, "We must get him back to the ship." And now, no doubt, he was being carried. But that part of his mind, which wasn't taken up with the burning pain and the unearthly violet in which he had his being, observed that the seamen took Padine's presence for granted, and that they comforted him in his distress. Now there was the easy motion of the boat, the creak of foal pins, the sea air on his stiff, tumid, sightless face. And now, among the perceptions that failed him were those of pain and of time. So that, although he heard both Jack's deeply anxious voice saying to Padine, "Lay him in my cot, Coleman, and then jump down to the gunroom for his leather cushion, you know where it is," and the often repeated explanations at the ship's side, he couldn't set them in order. Nor had order any significance in this immeasurably deep, violet well. Then his concern at the loss of sequence disappeared,
and with the eventual return of light and a confused sense of time, his recollection of the loss faded. Time started again quite far back, with the strong voice saying they must return to the ship, and the events leading to those words, and the reason for his present inner happiness, fell into place, though not without a lingering dream-like imprecision as he lay there at his ease, contemplating. Back to the ship. And indeed, here was the old familiar rise and heave, the creak of his hanging cot, the attenuated smell of sea and tar. But it was not quite right either. For now, here again was Padine's face hanging over him, which was nearer delirium or dream than reality. Yet at all hazards he wished the face a good day, and Padine, straightening with a great smile on his solid, factual face, said, "And God and Mary and Padraig be with your honour." Then in English,
"Captain, sir, he has spoken in his senses."
"Dear God, I'm so happy to hear it," said Jack. And very gently, "Stephen, how'd you do?" "I have survived, I find," said Stephen, taking his hand. "Jack, I cannot tell you how ardently, how very ardently I look forward to going home."
The End. You've been listening to The Nutmeg of Consolation by Patrick O'Brien, narrated by Patrick Tull.